Welcome to Life in the Front Office. I'm your host, Jake Hirschman, and today I've got Pat Gallagher along with Pam Gardner, two longtime execs in the baseball industry. Really fortunate to have the two of them on today. And we're going to talk a little bit about Pam's background as the former president of the Houston Astros and all of the other accomplishments she's had throughout her career, and kind of where Pat's intersected within the baseball landscape with her as well. We'll kind of go from there. So, Pat, want to take it away and introduce Pam?
Yeah. Hey, Pam, thank you so much for agreeing to do this. It's a, you know, I've been looking forward to speaking with you, not only to find out sort of where the things that you're doing now, but really to talk about your time with the Astros and how you got there. I mean, you started out in the ad business. You were in the agency business somewhere. How did you jump from the agency business to baseball?
I guess I was in the right place at the right time. I was vice president of an ad agency in Chicago, and we specialized in working with Broadway theater, traveling, touring productions, and sports, different sports things. We worked with the White Sox, Michael Jordan, little things like that. Anyway, I moved to Houston for family reasons and sent a resume to the Astros, and the person who was in charge of marketing, advertising, had just left. So it was truly right place at the right time. That started the ball rolling in 1989.
So you sent a blind resume to the Astros. Right. I mean, it's amazing. I guess that's a good lesson out there, is that, you know, timing's everything, but you sort of have to be, you do have to be at the right place, the right time, with the right background. And so when you started out with the Astros, you were, as I recall, you were in communications. That's really how you
right.
got in.
That's
Talk
right.
a little bit about that and sort of the progress, you know, your progression with the Astros, because, you know, for a long time you progressed. You were one of the, if not the most prominent woman in baseball, which, you know, is great, but that also comes with a certain amount of, you know, challenges and opportunities.
Well, there was certainly some angst along the way, but it was a great journey. I can say that. It's an interesting journey because I worked for three different owners and through six different general managers. So it was a long journey. I was there about 23 years. I started as the director of communications. The club was sold and I was kept on, and I was moved to director of sales and marketing, then to vice president of sales and marketing, senior vice president, you know, the drill. And then, we built the stadium along the way, which I'm sure we'll talk about. But I just kept moving along, up the ladder. I actually, was thinking of leaving the team, and at that time the current the gentleman that was the president was leaving, and Drayton asked me would I take that job. So I've had a number of roles throughout the years. My last 11 years was as the president.
But you actually were with two different ownership groups. I mean, didn't you start with the McMullen group, and
yeah.
then a lot of times that's the sort of the time to leave. Somebody wants to bring in somebody knew their people. Why do you think that that Drayton wanted you to stay?
Well, you know, it was interesting. Drayton had a really different philosophy, as you know. He came in and he actually said to the entire team, look, I don't know anything about baseball. You all do. I'm going to leave everything as it is for the next year, see if you like me and I like you. So he really kept nearly everyone. With very little exception. And then as the year went by, you know, some people left on their own and some didn't quite fit with his style. Actually, I didn't quite fit with his style. It took him a while to get used to me. We kind of circled the wagons a little bit. You know, he owned a truck
yeah.
company in Central Texas. He was used to working with truck drivers.
With guys.
With a bunch of guys. So I was kind of a stretch. And we really had to get to know each other before, you know, we moved forward with a really good partnership for many, many years.
Pam, I gotta ask you, as you've worked for multiple bosses, especially owners, you know, with probably a very quick, you know, trigger in terms of being able to kind of do what they want. How did you adapt in those situations, and what was the approach that you took as you were working with different people, and then also having different people underneath you as well?
Well, that's a good question. Dr. McMullen on the team, when I came in, he was from New Jersey. In fact, I had one interaction with him. I worked for him for almost 4 years. I was down at spring training and he walked into the press room and he looked at me and he said, "Hey, honey, where's the coffee?" That was my entire conversation with Dr. McMullen. I wasn't quite high enough up on the chain. He didn't come to Houston very often. So when Drayton bought the team, so I worked for people that worked for him. So I didn't have much direct contact with him. And then Drayton bought the club. And of course, he was very hands-on. I mean, Dr. McMullen was called Dr. McMullen. And then Drayton McLean came in and he said, "Call me Drayton." So it was really a 360. It was very, very different. You had to get up to speed with Drayton or you would perish, I guess is the way to say it.
Yeah. And so at that time you had, you know, you were, you know, you inherited a lot of staff, and also at that point, describe also, you know, developing the culture that would not only bring this all together under a new owner who was, you know, not familiar with the game, but also would propel you into eventually figuring out how to get a new ballpark built.
You know, that's where I really bonded with Drayton, because he had a very small inner circle. I wasn't in it, obviously, when he first bought the club. He's a very gung-ho guy, very, very different, but he was a marketer. And so from that perspective, we did gel because he understood the value of marketing. So every player that you traded for, every single thing that you did was relevant to marketing. And he understood that. He still is a great marketer. So that really was what gelled us. We started the process on the stadium in the late 90s. And there were actually four of us that worked on the project. I really did, because I organized a lot of the women's groups, because we had to pass a referendum. So I organized a lot of the women's groups and I produced a lot of the marketing materials around building the stadium. So that's when I really got to know him, because we all had to work together. If we didn't get the referendum passed, we wouldn't have a stadium.
And so the in that referendum, it was a, you know, at least part of the funding, maybe all the funding was through taxpayers, right?
Well, actually, it was through car and hotel rental. So it wasn't taxed on the Houstonians, which really was the benefit. But we only passed the referendum by 1%.
Yeah, it was the visitors who really helped pay, right?
The hotel taxes.
Yeah. It's those that couldn't vote that that took the hit, unfortunately. However, well, it's been great for the city, and it's paid back a thousand times. So we had to have a new stadium. I mean, we were in the Astrodome, which was built in 1965 with 55,000 seats. And you're looking at, Pat, you know the story. You guys,
at
the same time we did. Looking at, you know, 10,000 empty seats in the outfield, because that's the way it was. And we weren't a very good ball club.
And also, you know, the Astrodome referred to it as the seventh wonder of the world, or the eighth wonder of the world, I guess, when it was built, you know, Judge Roy Hofheinz.
Right.
And actually a guy that I worked for at the Giants, Speck Richardson, who was the general manager. And it's, you know, so at the time was great. I mean, it was most famous early on when the Giants were actually came there to play. I'm not sure if it was a regular season game or an exhibition game. And, you know, probably the greatest center fielder of all time, and a pop fly went into the outfield and he couldn't see it.
Right.
Because of all the glass on the roof, which all of a sudden had to be changed. And then they had to develop this stuff called AstroTurf.
Right.
Which to replace the natural grass. And, you know, the story after that is pretty amazing. But during the time when you were going through the new stadium stuff, you know, at least one of the things that you would have to contend with is you'd have to have people who would be working on the sort of on the new effort.
Right.
But you have to have people who are concentrating on running the business.
Right.
And then a few of you would have two full-time jobs in that you would be, you know, you would be kind of straddling this whole thing. Describe how you did that.
Well, you know, I honestly, Pat, when I look back on it, I think I was too young to know to be afraid of it all. Building the stadium was a thrill because the way that we did it, which was a little bit different, is that Drayton funded the design before the referendum passed. So we didn't have a lot of interference from, you know, a lot of political pressure. We didn't have, you know, everybody shows up to tell you what they want in the stadium.
Sure.
So there were actually four of us, Drayton, Bob McLaren, who was president at the time, and then, of course, Tal Smith, an all-time great front office person himself. And the four of us actually did design and concept on the stadium. How many seats, how many suites, where the stadium faces, do you want the whole deal?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so the stadium was just the most thrilling thing to work on. Now, trying to work on the business, I think what I would tell you is that, you know, if you hire good people and they do their jobs, then yours is more oversight. And hopefully you get to that place. And hopefully we were somewhere around there at the time that I really had a great staff that really pulled through and got it done. So, but I will tell you, I wasn't home very much.
Pam, you had two full-time jobs and then you had a full-time job at home because you're a mom too. I mean, you have children.
Yep. I had two kids and I remember some nights coming home at, you know, 11:30 and my high school age son was waiting for me to go running with him because that's the only time I could do it. Good boy.
That was probably the last thing you wanted to do at that point, right?
Well, I'll tell you, I may do it differently. If I, you know, looking back on it, I would do it differently. But, you know, when you're living it, you just do it. And, you know, that's life. We just did it. Of course, the great thing is you take your kids to the game with you. So there was an advantage, too. But
sure. So I want to shift gears a little bit because aside from, you know, all this responsibility, I mean, and actually persevering through this, you know, you were recognized, you voted into the Texas Baseball Hall of Fame, a lot of accolades. But, you know, to be a woman in this position, so what would you say to some of the women who are, you know, might be listening to this podcast, maybe new to the business? What is it that you would contribute to sort of your success and moving forward? And, you know, why did people follow you?
You know, I love leadership. I just think that, you know, a really good leader takes you to a new place. And I've had so many mentors in my life. I would say, you know, midway through my career is when I realized that, well, yes, in fact, that's what you are. And you have a responsibility. And so I had this list of things that I would always follow. And I would always share that with everyone. I worked really hard on making our front office diverse, gender-wise, race, religion, everything. We tried to be very inclusive. That was really one of my projects. I worked really hard on that. I wish more teams would. I wish baseball would take a bigger role in that. But I think people follow me because I was tough but fair. So the expectations were high, but if you really worked hard and did a great job, then you were rewarded for it, not just financially, but in what your position was and how you could move forward. So, you know, I think that's just kind of the basic.
Pam, in terms of, you know, getting to the level that you did, being a president for 11 years and being the longest tenured, you know, female exec in the major leagues, what did you learn along the way? And then the follow-up question to that is, and Pat can chime in as well, but why did you want to be a president? I mean, some people in the industry will tell you once they get to that VP, senior VP level, I don't want to be a general manager. I'm good where I'm at, or I don't want to be a president. I don't want all that weight on my shoulders. What was it about you know, having that position and then having that responsibility that motivated you to get there?
You know, I had a really good team, and the team stayed, we stayed together a long time. My question to you would be, who wouldn't want to be a president of someone that has a dream? but that's how I'm wired. So I'm wired to do the next thing and do the next thing. And what can we do that's better? And how can we make it greater? Boy, I've learned a lot of things over time. I was, you know, obviously very young when I started. Some of the things I learned early on is that you don't have to be the one with all the answers. You don't have to know all the answers. You know, your job is to lead, and you find the answers by surrounding yourself with good people. So I think that's really one of the basic things that that I felt we felt as though we did well on the business side. And that was a really hard thing to learn, because sometimes you think you are supposed to have all the answers. Well, no. And I always made it a point to hire people that were smarter than I was at the other areas of the business. Because the more people you have that are smarter than you, the higher you all go.
Is there a particularly tough decision that you made that you may want to either admit or talk about? But it's, you know, it to be the leader, to be the president, to do it, you know, it's sort of, in a lot of ways, you know, you get all the bad assignments, you know, things have to, meaning that, you know, you have to make the, you know, that you have to make the long putts. Al Rosen used to say, you know, you've got to make the long putt. And so tell me about any of the decisions that you had to make along the way that were really difficult and sort of what happened.
Wow. There were a lot of difficult decisions. Wow. We all have stories, as you know, and we all make mistakes. But I think leaders learn from their mistakes. Tough decisions. I think the hardest was always dealing with.
Pat, you put her on the spot.
No. I can feel that she's sweating right through the phone. It's great. It's fantastic.
Well, I always felt like that most of my time was spent on the people, developing people, making sure they did the right thing. I think one of the hardest decisions is when you have to move someone on who isn't doing the right thing. You emailed me and said you weren't going to ask me about Enron, but, you know, I mean.
Well, you gave me an open door, so let me set this up a little bit. because I also did a deal with Enron when we built, you know, Pacific Bell
right.
Park.
You
so
did.
They were, I mean, a major deal with Enron. Yeah. And this was, you know, I traveled to Houston, was in the big building, the glass building. I went to the trading floor. At least I think it was the real trading floor, not the phony one. And I'm not sure. But the name of your ballpark was Enron Field. I mean, it was, you know, you opened up that way. And all of a sudden, when that company sort of went away and in the way they did, tell me about what that was like.
Wow, I started as a president in August, and then I think it was September, and Enron went under. So I'm like, wow, because, you know, I mean, the revenue from that is significant.
Huge, yeah.
And their name's on our building. So, and they're going through bankruptcy. So that was a real process. I mean, we really had, I mean, first of all, we wanted to take the name off the building immediately, but we couldn't wait because they were going through bankruptcy. So we had to negotiate getting our name back so we could call it Astros Field until we could find a new naming partner. So that was really the first step. And then we actually had to buy our name back. Which is another story, ironically. And then my first assignment was really trying to find a new naming rights partner. And we spent months on that, and it just going out and meeting with people and getting it done. That was probably one of the toughest things. And then, you know, you never know if you're making the right decision. You make the decision you think is best at the time, which I think, I mean, obviously was a great decision. We ended up with Minute Maid. You couldn't have gotten any further away. You couldn't get any more holes.
No, it's great.
Than Minute Maid. But we had several suitors. So we really had to work through that. That was in the heyday of naming rights. But that was a tough time. It was a tough time for the whole city, as you might imagine, let alone just the stadium.
Well, all the people, and I remember even the people that I dealt with at Enron, you know, some of them, you know, some of them managed to get out and you know, get out with their lives. Some of them didn't.
I know.
And it was very sad, but it's one of those things that, you know, taught me a lesson about, I guess, about trust in a way. But also having if your ideas are bright and your intentions are right, you know, you can work your way through these things. And it was I have to admit, we had to deal with our own little Enron issue in San Francisco with what they contributed to our ballpark. But I didn't have their name on the ballpark.
Right.
I mean, you covered up. Did you actually cover up all the signage and make it Astros ballpark before Minute Maid came?
We actually took the name down, the signage down, and we called it Astros Field until we located you know, the smartest thing we ever did is when we built the stadium, we did not put their logo on the side of the seats. The 42,000.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
I can only imagine.
Because we had to make that decision before we had a naming rights partner. So all it said, the seat standards said Astros baseball.
Well, and I'll tell you, I wasn't that smart. There was a company in the Bay Area called Webvan. I don't know if you remember that name, but Webvan was a grocery delivery company. And I did put their name. It was Pacific Bell Park, but at Webvan was on 40,000 cup holders
on
every one of the seats.
Oh.
And when they went under, we actually had a crew go and had to scrape the name off of 40,000 cup holders. But, you know, it's just one of the things that you do. And, you know, in an organization, I think you try to develop, you know, like you did, Pam, a good culture so that I think your customers also, if you try to do things, always make the right decision. But if you always try to make the right decision, sometimes they give you credit for running it right.
Yeah, and sometimes you don't get the credit, but you run it right anyway.
That's true.
So that's kind of the way it is. I mean, we had a thing, you know, Drayton used to always say, just do the right thing. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, operate with honesty and integrity. And it was never more clear than after that episode. But if your intention is always to do the right thing, then
it is.
It's due work out.
Yeah. One of your big accomplishments, all this was, you were able to put together I think it was a complicated, but it was a great a broadcasting deal, television deal. And I think, didn't you also do it with the Rockets?
We did. And that was, that was actually near the end of my tenure. Just before Jim Crane bought the team, a couple of years before that. We put it together with the Rockets. The Rockets actually sat out a year without a TV contract to sync up with us. And it just was one of those serendipitous things that worked. Of course, then we transitioned and the new ownership group came in and they viewed the business in a different way and have gone a different direction from what we had set up. But, you know, that was one of the all-time toughest deals I think I ever did. Other than selling the team,
Well, you got a chance to be in that, and you got a chance to do it, and you got out. You know, you sort of got out on your own terms, which
yep.
You know, a lot of people don't get a chance to do that, and also any of us who are in this, nobody gets to do this forever, but you got to do it, have great success with it, get out, and now you're on to something else. And I was looking and I was going to ask you about, you know, cause you're not in baseball anymore. You had a terrific career and you've moved on and you're running an organization, called Your Mind at Work Now. What's that all about?
So when I got out, I did, I was tired as you might imagine. And I spent the first couple of years really doing community work. I did a lot of political work. I chaired the mayor's finance committee for her run. I chaired the mayor's committee to end chronic homelessness in Houston. I sat on the sports authority board. I'm on the board of a of a oil company. So I did a lot of community and other kind of work for a couple of years and kind of settled in. I had a couple of opportunities to do things related to baseball, not in baseball, but related to. But quite frankly, you know, I sat down, Pat, and I thought to myself, I've seen over 3,000 games.
And a lot of them are forgettable.
Most of them were forgettable. And anyway, and so, you know, the organization I have is just a small organization with a friend of mine. And it's a consulting firm that works with people on leadership and that kind of thing. So we really, I'm not as active as you would think. I'm not running this multi-level organization. I'm working when I want to, doing consulting things as they come up. So it's on my terms this time.
That's good. So there's going to be a lot of people in the business who will be listening to this. There'll be some who aspire to get into our business. Tell me, you know, I love what you said before. Sometimes you do things because you don't know any better. But which, you know, I can subscribe to that. But what would you say to some of the young women who are listening to this? Fortunately, our industry is much more inclusive than it was. Still has a ton of ways to go. But what would you say to them?
You know, I always tell people my philosophy on hiring people anyway was to hire the best people, not based on what their degree was or their pedigree or their just really hardworking people. Because I think you can take anyone who's smart and strong and put them in a role and they'll flourish. I always tell young women, get your foot in the door. Well, I tell young men this too. Get your foot in the door. Take any job you can. Work your tail off and look for opportunity and then go in and ask for it. That's the best way that you can get in and move. I have to tell you though, Pat, I really feel like it depends on who the leadership group is, if you're going to be successful or not. They have to be open to it. Mm-hmm. They have to be open to wanting women in leadership positions in order for you to get in and move up. Unfortunately, some aren't. But those that are, get in, take any job, do it. Don't expect to start at the top, as a lot of people, you know, I have a master's degree and blah, blah, blah. I should be the vice president of, and that's not how it works in baseball, as you know.
It doesn't.
No. And the biggest disservice, I think, that colleges do now, so many have sports programs, and every kid thinks they're going to work in the major leagues. And, take anything you can in any sport that you can and learn as much as you can and then go in and ask for it. So,
we've seen a lot of people who have started as interns.
Right.
That's how Jake started started as interns. And I think that's probably a good way to not only make it a little less mysterious about actually what happens, but also, you know, you sort of become a known quantity.
Right. That's exactly right. Because once you're in and you understand the culture and you fit in the culture, you have a better opportunity to get in and move up. I would still like to see more women in the business. And I think the only way that that'll happen is if people make a concerted effort to hire women and then move them along, give them the same opportunity. But like I said, it depends on who owns the team and, you know, who's in charge.
Pam, how do you, you know, if you're in that position of, you know, like you said, going and asking for the opportunity when you see one, how do you find out or what are the right questions to ask in order to figure that out if you're in the right place to make that ask, right? Because you don't want to make it if the answer is going to be no, and you probably know that ahead of time. What are some of the things that you would advise people to look at or think about?
Well, that's a good question. I would, you know, and I'd like to hear Pat's thoughts on that as well, because I had an open door philosophy. I mean, our doors were always open. Mine was always open. Anyone that wanted to come and ask a question about where they stood or what their potential was would come in. I mean, I still have young women that work for me that call me and ask me about a situation that they have and what they should do. So, I mean, if you were working for me, I would tell you, just come into my office and say, what are my opportunities here?
It's not, you know, I think you're right, Pam. It's, if you approach it that way, it's not necessarily that complicated. I mean, I always say that, you know, we're not smashing atoms here. You know, we're not discovering a cure for a disease that kills people. We're supposedly in the fun business, and the fun business is, you know, it's can be difficult at times, but it's, you know, the visibility of it sometimes, you know, sort of gets in the way of the actual business of actually making it happen. And it's, you know, I think our customers also listen to the customers. I would always describe, and I did a previous podcast, you know, and I oversimplification of people, but, you know, I sort of looked at them as that either you're a problem solver or you're a problem creator. And that's a total oversimplification what it means is that look, everybody's got a boss, everybody's got a problem to solve. So I'm sitting there across the table trying to figure out whether you're going to come be part of our team. I'm trying to figure out, are you going to help me solve problems, or are you going to be a bigger problem? And, you know, sometimes you can't tell. And if you make a mistake in that vein, you have to sort of admit your own mistakes sometimes, which we all make, everybody makes. And so, right. But it is, I guess the good part of this picture is it's an incredibly great business, and it's a great, you know, you're talking about something that these are community assets. I mean, you know, the Astros, look what the Astros mean to the Houston community. They, you know, now they've, you know, they're world champions. But aside from just the baseball stuff, what they've done to sort of revitalize that part of town. One of the great things you did, Pam, was that a lot of other things happen at Minute Maid other than just baseball.
Oh, yes. We had a whole division that just did special events. And the Giants did the same thing. You know, I always felt we were very similar in what our markets were and, you know, what we could produce and what we could generate and the payrolls that we could support. I always looked to your team because you guys were so creative. And you led that charge.
Well, the competition, the real competition's on the field. It, you know, it shouldn't be, you know, outside the white lines. We ought to figure out a way to do it. I got to ask you this one question I've been kind of waiting, is that, you know, in Houston was also the home to the Bush family.
Right.
And a lot of times you would be watching on television and you'd see him behind home plate.
Right.
You know, I always wondered, you know, if George Bush fell asleep, you know, you'd see him right there, you know, on television. But just describe what it was like to get to know them, you know, terrific people.
You know, they're Houston sweethearts, obviously. They live there. They had a home there, and they were such fans. And George Bush was really good friends with Drayton, which is why he ended up with the seats behind home plate. And you know what? They were just kind people. When we did our referendum, they came and did a commercial for us let's keep the team in Houston. Let's build a stadium. George and Barbara showed up with their dog, Millie. I mean, and they would come down. They were just salt of the earth. They would come down to the Diamond Club and, you know, sit with whoever was down there and just have dinner and a chat. They were just salt of the earth. Really, really great people. And they just loved the team so much. It was fun to have them.
It was regular. That was my experience, regular people. And their son is you can argue about his politics, but in terms of a person, is probably as regular of a guy as he could be. So, that's the other nice thing about this business is you get to meet people that you probably wouldn't ordinarily get to meet.
Oh, there's no question. I mean, we all have stories. I think, you know, Drayton once said, hey, would you like to sit in a small group of people talking to Warren Buffett? I'm like, yeah, I would. And we flew to Kansas City, and he was there with David Glass, who owns the Royals. Mm-hmm. And he was talking to a small group of executives. He was a friend of David's. And I sat in a room with 20 people listening to him talk about the world economy. I mean, things like that, you would never get to do. It is like magic. I mean, the whole game itself is magic, and the people that surround it are magic. And it just is like being part of something so much bigger than you are, and that's the thrill of it.
Pam, I got a question for you in that, you know, you were with the Astros for such a long time, and, you know, as you kind of moved throughout your career, if you walked down the street or you were with your friends, I mean, that's probably who they knew you by, right? Was, oh, she works for the Astros. How did you separate the identity of where you worked? And, you know, Andy and I talk about this all the time. It's, you know, the loss of logo concept of, you know, how, you know, you were the president of the team, but who was Pam outside of being the president of the team? How did you go about that?
Well, you know, that was hard because I was there all the time. But wherever you went, which is, I mean, I have to tell you, about 3 years ago, I moved to Santa Fe, New Mexico, and didn't tell anyone what I did for a living. Every time you go out, you check yourself. Do I look all right? I mean, because that is you. And you can separate yourself, but you're still that. I mean, I would go out for a run and I'd turn a corner and somebody'd say, "Hey, Pam." And of course, they have advice, as you know. But it was hard to separate the two. And in fact, I think they just kind of melded together for so many years that it was a hard to separate that or to find my identity when I left. I mean, it was thrilling to do it, but it was also hard to do because that's who I was. And you're never home. So that is who you are.
Pat, well, did you have a similar experience?
Well, yeah. I mean, look, nobody can do this forever. You know, so the way I looked at it was, you know, I had I was privileged to be able to do it and make some things happen, make some mistakes along the way, and do some things that the community was proud of and I was proud of. And then you sort of hand it off to somebody else. And, you know, part of the reason why we're doing these podcasts is to sort of help let the next sort of generation of people who are doing it know that this is, you know, this is something that's accessible. I mean, you can do this. Yeah, the people who do these jobs, I used to always say that, you know, we're not 25 times more smarter than you are. We're not 25 times, you know, some would argue that, you know, that
25 times dumber, maybe.
Yeah, I'm dumber the other direction. But you know what? It is I think it's, we want to attract more people to consider this as something to do. And, you know, the sports management programs, I think they're terrific. But I really do think that that they would be doing a better service to their to the people in the schools to really talk about how do you get a real job? How do you start off with a real job? And that's sort of the, you know, you don't want to go through a whole education and then not be able to have a career path. And that's why we're doing this. We would like to people to think that this is accessible. And I think the other piece of it, too, is just to, you know, anybody along the way that wants to talk to you, an informational interview, you know, I think I've probably done thousands of them, but it's just more fun living that way. And Pam, I know you've always been that way.
Yeah. I think it's important. But, you know, that's so true what you say, because the expectations for a lot of young people is very high, and you can get there. You just have to work hard, stick to it. You know, the other thing I always tell young people, if you send, you know, don't just send a resume and let it sit, and don't just send it to, you know, the president of the organization. They get 4,000 of them. Send it to the president, the head of marketing, send it to, you know, send it to five different people in the company, and then do it again 2 months later, because, you know, I mean, as you know, Pat, you get hundreds of resumes.
Well, you do. And I always subscribe to the thing, when somebody says no, that doesn't mean no forever. It
right.
just means no right now.
That's,
you know,
right.
I always said, it's not really a no. It's maybe it's a maybe. And, you know, it could eventually be a yes if, you know, if you do it right. It's just, you know what, it just makes it more fun to be in it. And I think, so Jake, you want to wrap this up? How do we do this?
Absolutely. And I will, to your comment, Pat, over the last 2 weeks, I actually have gotten some messages on LinkedIn from some sports management students about, you know, hey, I love your podcast. You know, would you be able to connect? And I just think the power of that is so unique in that, you know, we are able to touch, you know, people and be able to try and help. And I'm actually having a conversation with someone next week already. So it's, you know, whatever we can do to help. And I know that I've got a long, long, long ways to go to get to where you guys were at, you know, at one point. But I think it's a lesson to everyone. It's, you know, you got to start somewhere, right?
Yep.
You got to start somewhere. Hey, Pam, thanks so much for doing this. Been looking forward to catching up with you anyway, but, you know, for you to let the listeners hear more about who you are and that, you know, you're a real person. And
you're a real person.
You are a real person. So,
I got one last question for Pam before we sign off. The new logos and new uniforms that you had to have throughout the Astros regime, were those all your decisions?
No, they're never all, everything is never all your decision. That's a whole process unto itself. To be honest with you, uniforms are driven by new ownership generally because they want their own mark. And we did that once. And we changed them a second time because Drayton kept saying, but I like red, but I like red, but I like red. And I kept saying, but we're not red, we're blue and we're orange. And so finally I just said, let's give them red. And so we changed them to red. And I actually love the uniforms that Jim Crane did because they're retro. They kind of go back to the beginning, which I love. So the process of uniforms is very stressful because you have to go through Major League Baseball. There's lots of approvals. I would say uniforms are decided by ownership. Pat, what would you say?
Yeah, I do too. I'd have to say, if you took a retrospective of the Houston Astros uniforms from the start to the finish, I mean, it was like, you know, it's like some of the people, some of those uniforms looked like you were on drugs, you know?
Yeah, yeah, that's true.
I mean, they were wild. But I do think it ought to be something that, not only ownerships, but I, you know, when we did it a couple times, I'd actually sit down with some of our former players. Willie Mays is one of the guys. He gave me a really great bit because I worked on the last vestige of the Giants, and they went through the softball look, and they went through a variety of looks. And he didn't design them, but he gave me one little bit of a tidbit that actually really helped, which was, you know, you go through the materials, and we used to have these, like, bright white uniforms, which were beautiful. But he said, you know, the uniform I played in wasn't because it was either flannel or muslin or whatever. It was actually more of a cream color. It wasn't a white.
Right.
He said, could you go back to that? And we went to the uniform manufacturer, and they didn't have anything like that. So they actually had to make a special sort of a Giants cream colored
very
uniform.
Far on the edge again, Pat.
Well, no, I just hey, you know what? If you listen to Willie Mays, he'll tell you what to do.
Yeah.
So lesson learned, just ask Willie, right?
Yeah, just a good listener, that's all. So,
I have a Willie Mays story I'll tell you sometime.
All right.
Awesome. Well, Pam, thanks again for your time. Pat, always appreciate it. Pam, always welcome on in the future to talk more, and looking forward to getting this episode out to all of our listeners, which we have surpassed 4,000 listeners. So continuing to grow, and looking forward to the episodes to come.
I enjoyed it, guys. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Pam. Day. You're the best.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
The podcast you just heard was made using Anchor. Ever thought about making your own podcast? Anchor makes it really easy for anyone to get started. It's a one-stop shop for recording, hosting, and distributing podcasts. Best of all, it's 100% free. Sign up now at anchor.fm/new. That's anchor.fm/new to get started.